You are listening to This Week in Palestine, Truth and Justice Radio, WZBC, Boston College. Before we begin, a brief reminder for our listeners. The views expressed in this hour belong solely to our hosts and guests. They do not necessarily reflect those of WZBC, Boston College, or its Board of Trustees. You're tuned in to This Week in Palestine, and this is not a space for polite restraint. This is a space where truth stands unmasked, truth spoken clearly, urgently, and without apology. Good morning. Good evening. Wherever you are in the world, whether you're driving through the day or night, sitting at your kitchen table, or listening quietly in the dark, thank you for choosing to be here with us. I'm your host and narrator, Abby Mosri, and today is Sunday, April 5th, 2026. Here on This Week in Palestine, we do not soften the edges of reality. We do not trim the story to comfort the powerful. This is a home for unfiltered truth, a place where resistance is not a metaphor, but the heartbeat of daily survival. A place where solidarity is not a slogan, but an inheritance carried from one generation to the next. From the heart of occupation, voices rise, not alone, not as whispers swallowed by empire, but together, steadfast, unbroken, standing shoulder to shoulder with movements across the globe that demand justice, dignity, and liberation for all people. This hour is more than a broadcast. It is a lifeline, a thread stretching from Palestine to every corner of the world, binding shattered homes to unbroken hope, binding devastation to determination, binding grief to a future still worth fighting for. Even in the darkest nights, the ember of defiance refuses to die. Each week, we bring you coverage that cuts through distortion, analysis that refuses disguise, and reflections that center Palestinian life in all its depth, struggle, beauty, and humanity. We do not soften, we do not dilute. We speak with precision because the stakes are far too high for anything less. This Week in Palestine is not a refuge for polite avoidance. It is testimony. It is urgency. It is solidarity without apology. Because the struggle for liberation does not belong to one land, one people, or one moment in time. It is shared. It is global. And it is sacred. As all news faded away about Gaza, West Bank, and Palestine, and all news now focused on Iran, today we turn our attention to that matter. But before we study the impact of the Iran war, we need to understand what's going on. The American actions of the past months have pushed the world into a period of rapid, destabilizing change, a kind of global turbulence that most people are simply not prepared for. You can feel it in the markets, in the headlines, in the quiet anxiety that sits behind every conversation. Something is shifting, and it's shifting fast. Economic pressures are piling up from every direction, rising debt, stubborn inflation, and a global financial system stretched thin. These aren't isolated problems, they're converging all at the same time, creating a storm that no one in power seems willing to acknowledge honestly. And that's the part that should worry us most. because while the warning signs are flashing everywhere, our political leaders continue to downplay the severity of what's coming. They speak in rehearsed lines, in polished statements, in carefully crafted reassurances that don't match the reality unfolding around us. Meanwhile, the world's supply chains, the arteries that keep everything moving, are showing cracks. Energy markets are unstable. Global trade routes are more fragile than the public realizes. One disruption here, one conflict there, and the entire system trembles. So what happens next? Who feels the impact first? Not the politicians, not the corporations, not the people who make the decisions. It's the ordinary people, the workers, the families, the communities who will feel the first shockwaves. They'll feel it through higher prices, through shortages, through instability that creeps into daily life. They'll feel it in the grocery store, at the gas pump, in their rent, in their savings, in the quiet fear of not knowing what tomorrow will cost. And here's the truth we need to face. Ignoring the warning signs won't make them disappear. Pretending everything is fine won't soften the blow. Looking away won't protect us. If anything, denial makes the coming shocks harder to withstand. We need to stay alert. We need to stay informed. We need to prepare for a world that may change faster than anyone expects. Because the pace of global change is accelerating politically, economically, socially, and the people who will navigate it best are the ones who refuse to be caught off guard. This is not about fear. This is about awareness. This is about responsibility. This is about understanding the moment we are living in, a moment where the decisions of a few can reshape the lives of millions. The world is entering a new chapter, one defined by uncertainty and rapid shifts. And if we want to protect ourselves, our families, and our communities, we cannot afford to sleepwalk through it. We must pay attention. We must ask questions. We must challenge the narratives that are handed to us. And we must prepare mentally, emotionally, practically for a world that is changing in ways we have not seen in generations. Because readiness is not panic. Readiness is wisdom. Readiness is survival. And in times like these, readiness is the only thing that gives ordinary people a fighting chance. What is going on? That question is no longer whispered in private corners. It's spoken out loud now, in frustration, in disbelief, in fear. It's carried in the silence of people who stare at their screens, who watch the news, who scroll through headlines and feel the ground shifting beneath their feet. Because what we've been told, what we've been fed, does not match what we're seeing unfold before our eyes. For months, we heard the same lines repeated like a broken record. We are winning the war. Iran is begging for a ceasefire. Iran is finished. We control their airspace. We control the Strait of Hormuz. But every time those words were spoken, the world outside told a different story, a louder story, a clearer story, a story that did not bend to the script written in Washington. We were told Iran was on its knees. Yet Iran stood up, loud, defiant, saying no to a ceasefire. Not once, not twice, but repeatedly, and setting its own conditions. That is not the posture of a defeated nation. That is the posture of a nation that believes it has leverage. We were told the U.S. military had total control of the skies. Yet the skies lit up with Iranian ballistic missiles. Missiles that struck Israel. Missiles that hit U.S. bases. Missiles that contradicted every triumphant speech delivered on every television except the American television. We were told the Strait of Hormuz was firmly under U.S. control. Yet global shipping routes shifted, oil markets trembled, and even European nations quietly reached out to Iran, asking for assurances, asking for safety, asking for mercy. If we were truly in control, why would France, a NATO ally, feel the need to negotiate directly with Iran? Why would Iran respond with a demand so bold, so unapologetic, that it shook diplomatic circles across Europe? Remove American and Israeli embassies from your soil, and we will consider your request. That is not weakness. That is not defeat. That is power, raw, unfiltered, undeniable. And yet, here at home, our administration stands before cameras and tells us everything is fine, everything is under control, everything is going according to plan. But the world sees something else. The world sees a superpower stumbling. The world sees contradictions. The world sees confusion. The world sees a government that cannot keep its own story straight. Turn on international news and you'll witness a surreal split screen. On one side, the president declaring victory, insisting Iran is finished. On the other side, live footage of missiles streaking across the night sky, missiles that should not exist if Iran were truly destroyed. Two realities, one official, one undeniable, and we are expected to believe the official one. Then came the aircraft carrier incident, the moment everything felt even more suspicious. We were told the carrier withdrew because of clogged sewer pipes, a plumbing issue, an issue that will take 40 weeks to repair. That's the explanation given for why one of the most powerful symbols of American military might suddenly retreated 1,400 miles out of range. At the same time, Iranian sources claimed they had struck that very carrier. So which is it? A plumbing problem or a military hit? Why does it feel like we're being treated like children? Why does it feel like the truth is being hidden behind excuses that don't even sound believable? And here is the question that weighs the heaviest, the question no one in power seems willing to address. How are our soldiers doing? Are they safe? Did we lose anyone, anyone at all, whose names have not been reported to the public? These are not accusations. These are not claims. These are questions, human questions, moral questions, questions any nation should be able to ask without being dismissed. Because every time the administration dodges, every time they deflect, every time they hide behind vague statements about ongoing assessments, the suspicion grows. Families deserve clarity. The public deserves honesty. A nation deserves transparency. Instead, we get silence. We get contradictions. We get a government that seems more concerned with maintaining a narrative than telling the truth. And all of this, every contradiction, every denial, every half-truth, is happening against the backdrop of a region already on fire. The Middle East is not just unstable, it is unraveling. And the Palestinian struggle sits at the center of this unraveling. For decades, the West, especially the United States, has applied one set of rules for Israel and another to everyone else. One standard for allies, another for adversaries. One language for Palestinian suffering, another for Israeli security. And the world sees it. The world feels it. The world is reacting to it. As long as these double standards continue, the crisis will deepen. As long as Palestinian lives are treated as footnotes, resentment will grow. As long as justice is selective, instability will spread. This is not just a regional issue anymore. It is global. It is moral. It is a test of whether the world truly believes in human rights or only when it is politically convenient. And here at home, Americans are beginning to ask the questions they were never supposed to ask. Why were we told Iran was defeated when it clearly wasn't? Why were we told we control the Strait of Hormuz when we clearly don't? Why were we told our aircraft carriers withdrew for maintenance when the timing suggests something far more serious? Why are we not being told whether American soldiers were harmed? Why are we being treated like we cannot handle the truth? This is not about politics. This is not about party loyalty. This is about honesty. This is about accountability. This is about the right of the American people to know what is being done in their name. The world is shifting, the truth is surfacing, and the lies are collapsing under their own weight. So we return to the question that started it all. What is going on? Everything. And the American people deserve every answer. We want to know what we are doing in Iran. We want to know how we were dragged into this war. We want to know what is being hidden behind the curtain of official statements. We want the truth, not the version crafted for television, not the version polished for speeches, not the version designed to keep us quiet. We want the truth, and we will keep asking until we get it. So let's ask a question that almost no one in power wants to confront. What if it doesn't get better? What if the path we're on keeps spiraling downward, no matter how many speeches we hear, no matter how many promises are made, no matter how many times we're told to trust the process? What if we keep pouring our hardest earned money into a system that never pays us back? A system that enriches the wealthy, protects the powerful, and leaves everyone else scrambling just to stay afloat? A system that takes and takes and takes, and somehow always asks for more? Think about the billions, not millions, billions that leave this country every single year. Money that could rebuild our infrastructure, strengthen our schools, support our veterans, lower the cost of health care, and lift entire communities out of crisis. Money that could stabilize our economy instead of draining it. Money that could solve problems we've been told are too expensive to fix. And yet, year after year, those billions are sent overseas. And here at home, we're told to tighten our belts, to be patient, to wait for relief that never comes. So what happens in the next few months? What happens when the consequences of these decisions finally reach the people who had no say in them? These are not abstract questions. These are real, immediate, unavoidable realities. And then there's the decision that changed everything. The decision to enter a war without congressional approval. A decision that, in your view, dragged the entire country downhill, into chaos, into uncertainty, into a conflict that most Americans never asked for and never agreed to. You argue that this was a choice, one person's choice, and that the consequences of that choice are now unfolding in real time. You believe the situation is getting worse, not better. You believe the world is watching, reacting, and in some cases, laughing. You point out that global powers like China and Russia benefit from American missteps, that they gain influence every time the United States stumbles, that they gain leverage every time American leadership appears divided, distracted, or reckless. And from your perspective, you see them appreciating every mistake, every miscalculation, every moment of instability, because it shifts the balance of power in their favor. Meanwhile, ordinary Americans are left to deal with the fallout, rising prices, economic uncertainty, a sense that the ground beneath us is moving and no one in charge is willing to say it out loud. So today, you want to turn to analysis, not speculation, not rumor, but analysis. You want to explore what experts, economists, and geopolitical observers are saying about what may unfold in America soon. Not to create fear, but to create awareness. Not to spread panic, but to spark preparation. Not to point fingers, but to understand the moment we are living in. Because if the system keeps taking without giving back, if the economy keeps tightening while the cost of living rises, if global tensions keep escalating while domestic stability weakens, then we owe it to ourselves and to each other to pay attention, to ask the hard questions, to challenge the narratives handed to us, to look beyond the headlines and understand the deeper forces shaping our future. So let's listen, let's examine, let's break down the analyses of what may be coming economically, politically, socially, and what it means for the people who will feel the impact first. Because ignoring the warning signs won't protect us. Pretending everything is fine won't soften the blow, and hoping for the best is not a strategy. Awareness is not fear. Awareness is responsibility. Awareness is preparation. And in times like these, awareness is the only thing that gives ordinary people a fighting chance. Let's listen to these analyses.
More people left this country last year than moved in, for the first time since the Great Depression. Let that hit you. The United States of America, the place that the entire world has been trying to get into for the last 250 years, just experienced negative net migration for the first time in 90 years. And it's not just immigrants being deported. American citizens are leaving in record numbers, applying for foreign passports, buying homes in Europe, moving to Mexico, Romania, Albania, anywhere that their money actually means something. Because right here at home, $18.8 trillion in household debt is sitting on the backs of American families. Bankruptcy filings just jumped 11% in a single year and are projected to hit 640,000 in 2026, the highest since the financial crisis. 80 million Americans are working side hustles just to pay their bills. The economy lost 92,000 jobs in February. Gas jumped $1 a gallon in 1 month. Grocery prices are up 25% since 2020. And they are not coming back down. Beef is up 14% just from last year. Car insurance went up 46% in 2 years, and 59% of the people watching this video right now could not cover a $1,000 emergency without going into debt. And while all of that is happening, only 17% of Americans trust the government to do the right thing. That is the lowest number since they started asking the question nearly 70 years ago. 1 in 5 Americans is actively considering leaving the country. And the people who are staying are working 2, 3, 4 jobs and still falling behind every single month. Something is broken, not cracked, not bent, broken. And most people still haven't realized how bad it's about to get. This video is going to show you 10 things that are happening right now in this country that should fundamentally change how you think about your money, your job, your future, and whether the life you thought you had is even coming back. And I need you to watch all the way through because by the end of this, you're going to understand something that most Americans won't figure out until it's already too late. Let me hit you with something that completely blew my mind when I first came across it, and I think once you hear this, you're going to feel the same way. For the first time since the Great Depression, more people left the United States last year than moved in. I'm going to say that one more time because I need it to sink in. More people moved out of America than moved into America. According to the Brookings Institution, the United States experienced a net negative migration of roughly 150,000 people in 2025, and the projections for 2026 say it's going to get even worse. Now, some of you are hearing that and immediately thinking this is just about deportations and immigration crackdowns. And yeah, that's part of it. The Department of Homeland Security reported 675,000 deportations and 2.2 million self-deportations last year. But here's the part nobody is paying attention to. It's not just immigrants leaving. American citizens, born and raised citizens, are packing up their lives and leaving this country in record numbers. The Wall Street Journal did a massive investigation using data from over 50 countries, residence permits, foreign home purchases, student enrollments, all of it. And what they found is that Americans are voting with their feet like we have never seen before. A record 6,600 Americans applied for British passports last year. Over 40,000 Americans secured Irish passports. About 10,000 people moved to Ireland from the US, which is double the number from the year before. More Americans moved to Germany than vice versa for the first time. Luxury housing prices in Paris are surging because of wealthy Americans relocating there. One out of every 15 residents in Dublin's Grand Canal Dock neighborhood was born in America. Mexico is seeing a huge influx of American seniors moving in for low-cost nursing homes and affordable retirement. And when Gallup asked Americans during the 2008 recession how many wanted to leave, it was 1 in 10. Last year it was 1 in 5. Think about that. 20% of Americans are considering leaving their own country. People are calling it the Donald Dash, but honestly, this has been building for years. It's economics. It's the cost of living. It's healthcare. It's violent crime. It's the cost of housing. It's watching everything get more expensive every single year while your paycheck stays exactly the same. And the people leaving aren't all millionaires with beach houses in Portugal. There's a woman named McCoy who relocated to Romania and now works as a consultant helping other Americans with limited means do the same thing. She said she's helped 15 American clients move to Albania who are living on Social Security or disability. She said in Albania you can survive on $1,000 a month. Let that settle in your brain for a second. Americans are fleeing to Albania to afford to live. That's where we are right now. And if that doesn't tell you something is fundamentally broken about how this country operates, I really don't know what will. The gig economy safety net just snapped. Alright, so one of the ways that a lot of people have been getting by over the past 5 or 6 years, especially since the cost of living exploded after the pandemic, is the gig economy. Driving for Uber, doing DoorDash deliveries, Uber Eats, Instacart, things like that. And for a while it actually was a pretty solid move. If you had a car and a phone, you could start making money within a week. You could pull in an extra $400 or $500 a week without that much effort. During the pandemic, there were sign-on bonuses and promotions everywhere, and it actually felt like a real option for people who lost their jobs or needed a safety net. But fast forward to 2026, and that whole picture has completely fallen apart. First of all, the gig economy is totally saturated. So many people jumped on this bandwagon that in some cities you're literally put on a waiting list just to start driving. And at the same time, the cost of doing the work has never been higher. Gas prices have jumped about $1 a gallon just in the last month since the Iran war started. CNBC just did a big piece on this, and the stories coming out of it are brutal. There's an Uber driver in the Bay Area named Leslie Sherman Schaefer, who said it used to cost her $25 to fill up her Toyota Corolla. Now it's closer to $40. And she doesn't get reimbursed for gas. She said she relies entirely on the generosity of the tip, and most passengers don't tip at all. There's a DoorDash driver in Virginia named Sarah Noel, who now refuses any delivery that doesn't average at least $1 per mile, because the base pay from DoorDash is $2.50 per order. $2.50. That's the base. Half of her total pay comes from tips, and she's noticed that customers are tipping less as gas prices go up. So the driver is paying more, and the customer is paying less, and the platform is taking its same cut, and the whole thing is just collapsing in on itself. Diesel prices have climbed 44% over the past month, which means independent truckers, the people who move everything you buy across this country, are getting absolutely crushed. A freight broker in South Dakota told CNBC that diesel has a 70% chance of hitting $5 a gallon. And when trucking costs go up, those costs get passed to literally everything you buy at every store you shop at. Gridwise, which is a gig worker analytics firm, says that food delivery companies have been gradually lowering base pay for years while depending more and more on tips to keep drivers out on the road. And here is the kicker. The Economic Policy Institute found that after accounting for all vehicle expenses, gas, insurance, tires, depreciation, maintenance, the effective hourly wage for most gig delivery drivers falls below the local minimum wage. Think about that for a second. People are out there grinding 12 hours a day in their own cars thinking they're building something, and they're actually making less than minimum wage once you subtract what it costs to do the job. And the platforms know this. DoorDash, Uber, and Instacart just rolled out temporary gas relief programs, a few extra dollars a week, some cash back on gas if you use their debit card. But drivers are saying it barely makes a dent. What used to be a safety net for millions of Americans has become a treadmill where you have to run faster every single month just to stay in the same place. And with gas potentially heading to $5 a gallon, this whole system could genuinely implode, which means millions of people who have been depending on this to pay their bills are about to find themselves with no plan B. Everything in this country is becoming a scam. Can I be honest with you guys for a second? Like genuinely brutally honest? Because I feel like somebody needs to say this out loud. Everything in this country is starting to feel like a scam. And I'm not saying that as some conspiracy thing or some doomer take. I'm saying it because the numbers back it up, and I think deep down you already know it. Let's start with insurance, because this one makes my blood boil. Car insurance premiums in this country surged 46% between 2022 and 2024. 46% in 2 years. The average American is now paying $2,256 a year just to insure their car, according to the Zebra's 2026 State of Insurance report. If you live in Nevada, Louisiana, or Florida, you're paying over $300 a month. In Washington, D.C., the average is over $4,000 a year. And here's the thing that should really make you angry. A third of Americans, 32%, say their car insurance is straight up unaffordable. And 27% can't even afford their own deductible, which means even if something happens, they can't actually use the insurance they're paying for. They're paying every single month for something they literally cannot afford to use. And I saw this woman on social media talking about how her car insurance bill randomly jumped to $388, and when she called to ask why, they told her the cost of bodily harm went up because of inflation. She switched companies and saved $2,000 a year. $2,000. That's how much they were just taking from her, because they knew she wasn't paying attention. And these companies are banking on your exhaustion, guys. They are counting on the fact that you are too tired, too stressed, too overwhelmed by everything else going on in your life to sit on the phone for 3 hours and fight back. That is the business model. And it's not just car insurance. Home insurance has gone up 33% since 2020. In 2024 alone, there were 27 separate billion-dollar weather disasters in this country, which pushed reinsurance costs through the roof, which gets passed directly to you. Insurers have actually started pulling out of entire states. Florida, California, Louisiana, they're just leaving. And if you can't get private insurance, you get pushed into these state-backed last resort plans that have fewer options and often less coverage. And then you've got health insurance, which is its own horror show. You've got utilities going up, you've got subscriptions creeping up a dollar here, $2 there, until suddenly you look at your bank statement and you've got $400 a month leaving your account in subscriptions you forgot you even had. The whole system is designed to extract money from you as quietly and as constantly as possible. And the second you stop paying attention, they take more. That's not a free market. That's a trap. And millions of Americans are caught in it right now, and most of them don't even realize how much they're losing every single month because the scam is designed to be invisible. Your grocery bill is a lie. When was the last time you walked out of a grocery store and didn't feel like you just got robbed? And I'm not talking about loading up the cart with steaks and fancy stuff. I'm talking about the basics. Bread, milk, eggs, some chicken, a bag of rice, maybe some vegetables for the kids. You grab what you think is maybe $60 worth of groceries and somehow the register says $130 and you're standing there like, what just happened? Well, let me tell you exactly what happened. Food prices in the United States are up approximately 25% since 2020. That is a cumulative number that nobody in Washington wants to say out loud because it sounds as bad as it actually is. The USDA's Economic Research Service just released their March 2026 food price outlook, and they're projecting overall food prices to rise another 3.6% this year. Food at home, which is grocery store food, is predicted to go up 3.1%. Food away from home, which is restaurants and takeout, is going up 3.9%. And those are the averages. When you break it down by category, it gets way worse. Beef and veal prices in February 2026 were 14.4% higher than February 2025, 14% in 1 year, on beef alone. And here's where it gets really sneaky. A lot of these food companies have figured out that they can't keep raising the sticker price on everything because people will stop buying it. So instead, they just give you less. It's called shrinkflation, and 75% of consumers have noticed it, according to a recent survey. Your cereal box is lighter. Your chip bag has more air. Your peanut butter jar went from 18 ounces to 15 ounces, but the price stayed the same, or went up. They're hoping you won't notice, and honestly, a lot of people don't, because we're all so exhausted we just grab the stuff and go. And now on top of all that, the war in the Middle East is creating brand new supply chain disruptions. Fuel costs for shipping are surging. Fertilizer costs are getting squeezed because of trade route disruptions around the Strait of Hormuz. Diesel prices have climbed 44% in the last month alone, and every single thing in a grocery store got there on a truck that runs on diesel. A supply chain expert from E2Open just warned that food companies have already pulled every price management lever they have from the pandemic and from tariffs. There's nothing left. If costs keep going up, they either raise prices again, which makes people furious, or they shrink even harder, which makes the product feel worthless. Either way, you lose. And you know what the most frustrating part is? When they tell you inflation is coming down. Yeah, the rate of increase is slowing, but prices are not coming back down. That $4 loaf of bread is not going back to $2.29. That's gone forever. You're not paying less. You're just paying more, at a slightly slower speed. And for the 62% of consumers who told FMI they're very concerned about rising food prices, that distinction means absolutely nothing when you're staring at a grocery bill that takes a bigger bite out of your paycheck every single month. The Great American Migration is breaking the map. Something massive is happening with where people are living in this country, and almost nobody is connecting the dots on what it actually means. For the past 20 years, the big migration story in America was people moving south, Florida, Texas, Arizona, North Carolina. That was the trend. Sunshine. Lower taxes. Cheaper housing. Opportunity. Especially during the pandemic, these Sunbelt markets absolutely exploded. Prices went up by the day. It felt like you had to beg someone to sell you a house. But now that entire trend is reversing, and it's reversing fast. Some of the biggest metro areas in the country are now losing population. Los Angeles gained 38,500 people last year, but lost 131,000. Miami lost 114,000. New York City's population has declined 2% since 2020, and their immigration numbers have been negative for 6 straight years. Overall, the U.S. population only grew 0.5% last year, which is one of the slowest rates in modern history. And here's the twist, nobody expected. People are moving back to flyover country. The Midwest, places like Milwaukee, Cincinnati, Grand Rapids, Columbus, Indianapolis, and South Bend are seeing some of the biggest inflows of new residents in decades. States like Missouri, Indiana, and Wisconsin that used to be hemorrhaging people are now gaining them. And the reason is simple. It's the only place left where you can still afford to live. In Rockford, Illinois, the average home price is $170,000. In Cleveland or Toledo, Ohio, you can buy a house for $200,000. That's half the national median. And Rockford is actually the hottest housing market in the entire country right now, with home prices up 10% year over year. But here's the problem that nobody talks about. A lot of these Midwest areas have been economically dying for years. Storefronts are closed, businesses that existed 15 years ago are gone, and nothing replaced them. The housing is cheap, specifically because there's not a lot of opportunity, so you've got two types of people moving in. Remote workers making coastal salaries and bringing that purchasing power with them, and people who are flat broke and just need somewhere they can afford to exist. And when those remote workers show up with their $80,000 or $100,000 salaries in a place where the local median income is $40,000, they immediately start pricing the locals out. I'm already hearing this from family who still lives in the Midwest. The cost of housing, even though it's cheap compared to the rest of the country, is becoming unaffordable for people who have lived there their entire lives on local wages. It's the exact same thing that happened in Florida 5 years ago. And the people who got priced out of Florida are the ones doing the pricing out in Ohio. It's a cascading displacement that moves across the country like a wave. And at some point, when every affordable place has been discovered and overwhelmed, there's literally nowhere left to go, unless you leave the country entirely, which, as we talked about in number 10, a record number of Americans are already doing. The map of America is being redrawn right now in real time by affordability, and if you're not paying attention, you might find yourself on the wrong side of it. One job is not enough anymore. I need to talk about something that I think a lot of people watching this are living through right now, but nobody ever says it out loud in public because it feels like admitting failure. Having one job in America in 2026 is not enough anymore. And I'm not talking about minimum wage jobs. I'm talking about real careers, teachers, nurses, office workers, people with degrees and experience and skills who wake up every single morning, go to work, do their jobs, come home, and still cannot pay their bills without doing something else on the side. And the numbers are absolutely insane. According to Entrepreneur magazine, a record 8.9 million Americans are now working more than one job. The Washington Post reported that employers added 8 times fewer jobs in January than they did the same month a year ago, but the number of people working 2 jobs grew by 10% in that same period. Think about that. The economy is creating fewer jobs, but more people are working 2 of them. 39% of working Americans now have a side hustle, according to Side Hustle Nation. That's roughly 80 million people. Among millennials, it's nearly 50%. And a monster survey found that 47% of all U.S. workers are already polyworking, meaning they hold multiple jobs or roles at the same time. And nearly 60% said they're open to taking on multiple full-time jobs simultaneously just to stay afloat. And here's the part that breaks my heart. 65% of side hustlers told LendingTree they would prefer to have just one primary income. They don't want to be doing this. They're not doing it because they love the grind. They're doing it because one paycheck does not cover the cost of being alive in this country. 68% said they need the extra income just for basic expenses. More than half said it's essential for covering the cost of living. Almost half are using it to pay off debt. And a third are treating it as a safety net because they're terrified of getting laid off. The St. Louis Fed published data showing that Americans with more than one job are averaging 35 hours a week at their primary job and another 13 and a half hours at their additional jobs. That's basically a 50-hour work week across two employers, and those people are making an average of $57,865 a year. That is barely above the national median. You're working 50 hours across two jobs, and you're still middle of the pack. And then there's the stories that really stop you cold. I saw one about a couple with five kids, where between the husband and wife they are working 10 different jobs and still can't pay their credit card bill. The husband is a public school teacher making $4,000 a month working 40 hours, then does woodworking for 10 to 20 hours a week for another $1,000 to $2,000, then farms another 7 hours a week making nothing. The wife has 7 different gigs: freelance writing, nursing, library work, substitute teaching, and she just spent $400 getting a real estate license she hasn't made a dime from yet. And a woman named Chanda told the Wall Street Journal she works 40 hours from home for a medical supply company making $45,000 and then works 20 to 25 hours at Pizza Hut for $12 an hour. And all she said was two words, "I'm tired," and I think that's the truest sentence in America right now. Everyone is tired, not lazy, not unmotivated, tired. Because the math doesn't work, and everyone knows it, but nobody in charge will say it. Nobody trusts anything anymore. Have you noticed something lately? And I'm being dead serious here. Have you noticed that the conversations people are having now, at dinner, at work, in their group chats, on social media, are completely different from the conversations they were having 5 or 6 years ago? People are questioning everything, and I don't mean that in some conspiracy theory way. I mean regular, normal, everyday people are looking around and going, something is not right. The food doesn't taste the same. The jobs don't pay the same. The bills don't make sense. The news feels like it's from a different planet. And nobody in charge seems to have any answers. And the data backs this up perfectly. A Pew Research poll from just a few months ago found that only 17% of Americans trust the federal government to do what is right. 17%. In 1964, that number was 77%. We have gone from more than 3 out of 4 Americans trusting the government to fewer than 1 out of 5 in the span of 60 years. And it's not just the government. Gallup found that trust has cratered across the board. The Supreme Court is at 25%, Congress is at 7%. 7%. Guys, the criminal justice system, 14%. Television news, 11%. Public schools, 28%. Organized religion, 31%. The presidency, 23%. Every single one of those numbers has dropped significantly in just the last few years. The 2026 Edelman Trust Barometer, which surveys nearly 34,000 people across 28 countries, found that only 21% of Americans believe the next generation will be better off, down 9 points from the year before, and satisfaction with democracy is falling. The belief that the government actually listens to you, what political scientists call external political efficacy, is dropping off a cliff. And effective polarization, which is the academic way of saying how much you despise the other political side, has surged 30 points since the year 2000. And here's the thing that really got me when I was researching this. A PNA's Nexus analysis that looked at two of America's longest-running surveys going back to 1948 found something that is honestly kind of chilling. Americans have somehow maintained their personal sense that their own life is manageable while simultaneously watching the entire architecture of collective life crumble around them. People feel fine individually but believe the system is completely broken. And those two things coexist year after year, survey after survey, no matter who is in office. You ask someone how they're doing personally, they say okay. You ask them how the country is doing, they say it's falling apart. That gap is the most dangerous thing in America right now, because it means people have given up expecting the country to function. They've mentally checked out of the social contract. They manage their own survival, and they've stopped believing the institutions are going to manage anything at all. And when an entire population quietly gives up on the system while still going through the motions, that is not stability. That is the calm before something breaks. And if you've been feeling that yourself, if you've been having those conversations with people you trust, and everyone seems to be saying the same thing, that something fundamental has shifted since 2020, that things just don't feel the same anymore, you're not crazy. The data says you're right. The life you thought you had is gone. I want to talk about something that doesn't show up on any chart or in any economic report, but I think is the most important thing happening in America right now. And it's this. A lot of people, maybe even you watching this right now, are mourning something. Not a person. Not a place. They're mourning a version of life that they used to have that no longer exists. And they can feel it, even if they can't fully explain it. Before 2020, life wasn't perfect. Nobody is saying that, but there was a feeling to it. A rhythm. You went to work, and it covered your bills. You went to the grocery store, and didn't do math in your head while you shopped. You could take your kids to a restaurant without spending $80 on chicken fingers and lemonade. You could get sick and go to the doctor without wondering if the bill was going to bankrupt you. There was a basic sense that if you played by the rules and worked hard and showed up, the system would more or less hold together for you. And now that feeling is gone. And I think what makes it so hard is that nobody really announced it. There was no single moment where someone said, okay, the old deal is over, here's the new one. It just slowly eroded. A little more expensive every month. A little harder to get ahead every year. A little less trust in every institution. Until one day you look around and you realize the country you thought you lived in is not the country you're standing in anymore, and people are dealing with this in very different ways. Some people are angry. Some people are depressed. Some people are checking out entirely, buying vans, moving to the Midwest, leaving the country, disconnecting from the news, going off-grid. You see it everywhere on social media. People saying things like, I miss the days when I didn't know all this. People saying nothing hits the same anymore. People saying 2019 was the last good year. And whether that's fully accurate or not, the sentiment is real, because something did shift. Something fundamental changed in the relationship between the American people and the American system. A financial expert that I follow put it perfectly. He said the question he gets asked more than anything right now is when will things go back to normal? And his answer was the normal that people are thinking of will never exist again. That's not pessimism. That's just math. Prices went up 25% in 5 years, and they are not coming back down. Wages did not keep up. Housing doubled in many markets. Credit card debt hit $1.3 trillion. The trust fund that pays your Social Security is 6 years from running dry. Interest on the national debt is eating $1 trillion a year. And the job market just lost 92,000 jobs in a single month, while AI is replacing entry-level positions faster than new ones are created. There is no policy, no election, no single law that reverses all of that overnight. The old scaffolding that held American life together, affordable housing, reliable employment, functional healthcare, trust in institutions, a basic belief that tomorrow would be better than today, all of that has been dismantled piece by piece over the last two decades. And 2020 just ripped the curtain back so everyone could see it at the same time. So if you've been feeling like something is off, like the world doesn't operate the way you were told it would, like every month is a little harder than the one before, you are not imagining it, you are not being dramatic, and you are not alone. Millions of people are waking up to the same realization at the same time. And what we do with that realization, whether we let it paralyze us, or whether we use it to make different choices and protect ourselves, that's what this moment is really about. They pulled the ladder up behind them. I want you to sit with something for a minute, because this is the thing that nobody in politics, nobody on the news, and nobody in your parents' generation wants to talk about, honestly. Your parents' generation bought their first house in their mid-20s. They did it on a single income. The median home price in 1980 was about $47,000, and the median household income was around $21,000. That's a ratio of roughly 2.2 to 1. You could buy a house for a little more than 2 years of your total household income. Today, the median home price is over $430,000, and the median household income is around $80,000. That's a ratio of 5.4 to 1. And when you factor in mortgage rates, which are sitting at 6.2% versus the rates previous generations locked in at 3 or even 4%, the monthly payment gap is astronomical. An American family now needs $114,000 a year to afford the median-priced home according to Realtor.com. That's a 37% increase, a $47,000 jump from just 2019. The average salary in America is $64,000. You see the problem. And it gets worse. In 1950, more than half of 30-year-olds in America had both a family and a home. By 1990, that number had dropped to about 43%, which was a slow and understandable cultural shift over 40 years. But then, between 1990 and 2025, it collapsed. It went from 43% to 13%, a 70% drop in just over three decades. Only one out of eight 30-year-olds today has the two things that used to be the absolute bare minimum markers of being a functioning adult in this country. And the median age of a first-time homebuyer has hit a record 40 years old. 40. Your grandparents bought houses at 23. Your parents bought houses at 28. And your generation is expected to wait until 40 and still probably can't pull it off. Meanwhile, Gen Z is carrying an average of $94,000 in personal debt, according to Newsweek. A third of them say they're financially underwater because of inflation and stagnant wages. Only 26% of Gen Z owns a home. And here's the part that should make you furious. 61% of baby boomers say they will never sell their homes. Not that they can't, that they won't. They're sitting on houses they bought for $75,000 that are now worth $500,000 with mortgage rates locked in at 3% or less, and they have no intention of letting those homes enter the market. So you have an entire generation hoarding the single most important wealth-building asset in American history, while the generations behind them can't even get in the door. And the cruelest part of it all is that the system that built that wealth for the older generation, cheap housing, strong wages, pensions, affordable education, functional healthcare, they systematically dismantled every single one of those things over the last 40 years. They got theirs, and then they pulled the ladder up behind them. Pensions got replaced with 401ks that put all the risk on the worker. Tuition went from affordable to predatory. Healthcare became a profit machine. Housing became an investment vehicle instead of a basic need. And then they turn around and tell you that you're not working hard enough or you're spending too much on avocado toast. While they sit in a house that's tripled in value doing absolutely nothing. The American dream didn't die of natural causes. It was killed by the people who benefited from it the most. And then closed the door so nobody else could get in. You are watching a country decide what it wants to be. Everything we just talked about in this video, every single number, every single story, every single data point, they're all symptoms of one thing, and it's the thing that nobody on either side of the political spectrum wants to name, because naming it means admitting that none of the easy answers work. What is happening in America right now is not a recession. It's not a rough patch. It's not a cycle that's going to correct itself in a year or two when the next president takes office, or the Fed cuts rates, or the war ends. What is happening is a country that is in the middle of deciding what it wants to be. And the reason it feels so chaotic and so disorienting and so exhausting is because that decision has not been made yet. Americans are fleeing the country for the first time since the Great Depression. The gig economy that was supposed to give people freedom is collapsing under its own weight. Insurance has become a racket. Groceries cost 25% more than they did 5 years ago, and they're not coming back down. Entire cities are emptying out while the Midwest fills up with people running from unaffordable lives. 39% of working Americans need multiple jobs to survive. Trust in every institution from the government to the media to the church is at historic lows. People are mourning a version of life that no longer exists, and an entire generation has been locked out of homeownership while the generation above them refuses to let go. Those are not separate problems. That is one system failing in 10 different directions at the same time. And the question that nobody wants to ask because the answer might be terrifying is this. What if it doesn't get better? What if this isn't a dip on a graph that's going to swing back up? What if this is the new baseline? What if $4 bread and $2,200 car insurance and 40-year-old first-time homebuyers and record credit card debt and AI replacing your coworker and 17% trust in the government is just what America looks like now? I'm not saying that to depress you. I'm saying it because I think pretending it's going to magically reverse is more dangerous than facing it head-on. The people who are going to be okay through what's coming are not the ones who are waiting for things to go back to normal. They're the ones who accepted that normal is gone and started building something that works in the new reality. That means getting out of high-interest debt right now. That means building a skill that can't be automated. That means having an emergency fund even if it's $25 a week. That means having hard conversations with your family about money, about housing, about what the actual plan is if things get worse before they get better. The country your parents grew up in is not the country you're standing in. and the country you're standing in right now might not be the same country you're standing in 2 years from now. That's not pessimism, that's observation. And the only people who get blindsided by the future are the ones who refuse to look at the present. So look at it, all of it, everything we talked about today. Don't turn away from it. Don't scroll past it. Don't tell yourself it'll work out, because it won't work out on its own. It only works out if you make it work out. And that starts with seeing things as they actually are, not as you wish they were. Look, I know this was a lot, and I know a lot of what I just said is hard to hear. But I genuinely believe that the people who are going to come out the other side of this okay are the ones who are paying attention right now. Not panicking, not doom scrolling. Paying attention, understanding what is happening and making smart moves before they're forced to make desperate ones. If this video showed you something you didn't see before, or if it put into words something you've been feeling but couldn't quite explain, do me a favor and send it to one person who needs to hear it. Not for the algorithm, because I think these conversations matter, and they're not happening enough in the places where they should be happening. At the dinner table, between friends, between parents and their kids who are out there trying to figure out how to survive in this thing. And if you want to keep following this, because I promise you this story is not over, it's evolving every single week, make sure you hit that subscribe button and turn on notifications. Because I'm going to keep breaking this down as it unfolds. No spin, no agenda. Just the data and what it actually means for your life. Take care of yourselves out there. Take care of your families. And I will see you in the next one.
And with that, we arrive at the end of this week's journey together. Carry your curiosity with you. Carry your courage. And keep holding on to the questions that unsettle power, break open silence, and move us inch by inch toward justice. I'm Abby Masri, your host and narrator. It has been a privilege to share this hour with you. An hour rooted in unfiltered truth, in resistance lived with dignity, and in a solidarity that does not bend, does not bargain, and does not disappear when the world looks away. If something you heard today stirred something in you, if it challenged you, unsettled you, or called you forward, and if you ever feel the pull to sit behind this microphone yourself, know this, your voice has a place here. Reach us anytime at twippodcasts@gmail.com. To our listeners, thank you. Thank you for your time, your trust, and your willingness to walk this difficult road beside us. And to the remarkable team whose labor keeps this program alive, Bob Funk, Stanley Robinson, Stephen Lowe, Sophia Rose Woolman, Tahani Abu Musa, Dr. Bethany Marks, Dr. Rana Awad, Professor Yara Rashid, Juliet Salami Olivier, Renaud Al-Ghul, and our editor, Mohammed Al-Ghul. Your dedication, your clarity, and your steady hands are the heartbeat of this show. Week after week, you remind us that storytelling is not simply craft, it is inheritance, it is struggle, it is care. It is collective memory carried forward. This Week in Palestine is produced by Truth and Justice Radio, broadcasting for more than two decades from WZBC Student Radio at Boston College. If you missed any part of today's hour, you can find us on YouTube, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, Podcast Index, iHeartRadio, Podcast Addict, Pocket Casts, Deezer, Listen Notes, Overcast, Castro, Podchaser, Castbox, Player FM, Good Pods, and True Fans. You can also explore our full archive on radioforall.net and archive.org. Just search This Week in Palestine, or TWIP, and look for the image of the little girl raising her hands in the victory sign. We're also on Million Podcasts, a platform uplifting Arab American creators and helping listeners discover new voices. Visit www.millionpodcasts.com to explore their growing library, including ours. Thank you for being here. Thank you for listening. We'll return next week. Until then, take care. Stay grounded. Stay steadfast. It is not Israel. It is occupied land. It is Palestine. Free Palestine. From the river to the sea.